An outer space spectacular that was the stuff of dreams only a generation ago began snapping into the sharp focus of reality today. After its billion-mile journey from Earth, the Voyager 1 spacecraft sent back pictures of man's closest look yet at the ring planet Saturn. The closest encounter of spacecraft and planet occurs later tonight when Voyager sails just 77,000 miles from Saturn's yellow clouds. But already one scientist said, in the strange world of Saturn's rings, the bizarre has become commonplace.
You're listening to Good Heavens, a podcast about the universe with Wayne and Dan.
You just heard the late CBS Evening News anchor Walter Cronkite broadcasting on the evening of November 12th, 1980. The lead story that night wasn't bad news, but good news. For the first time since Galileo trained his small telescope on the strange contours of Saturn in the summer of 1610, mankind would soon be gazing upon the glorious wonders of the ringed planet up close. The Voyager 1 satellite traveled a billion miles to the ringed jewel of our solar system to give astronomers and the rest of our planet stunning, never-before-seen portraits of Saturn's spellbinding grandeur. Rings inside of rings, new moons, and even a shockingly unexpected discovery atop the planet's North Pole. Saturn proved to be even more hauntingly magnificent than most had imagined. In November of 1980, I had just turned 12, and it was at this tender young age that I discovered the late planetary astronomer Carl Sagan's TV show, Cosmos, which also debuted in 1980. My fascination with the universe had begun, but little did I know at the time that my budding interest in the stars and astronomy was, in ways I still am unable to fathom, how Jesus was drawing me to himself. I did not finally become a Christian until my mid-20s, but I knew that God existed before then. How else could the universe have come about? How else could there have been a solar system adorned with the most stunning twinkling lights and breathtaking orbed Christmas ornaments we call planets? I sometimes like to think about removing all of our human classifications and names from the planets. It forces me to marvel and wonder at what they really are. Science is quite adept at detailing the structure and material composition of the planets and stars, but such classification schemes only tell us what the planets and stars are made of, not what they really are. So what are they then? Nothing less than the handiwork of God. Divinely powerful and poetic testaments of his calling into being that which did not exist. Entities which reveal God's glory, his power, and his righteousness. As Psalm 50 verse 6 proclaims, the heavens declare his righteousness. Psalm 19 likewise exclaims that the heavens are telling of the glory of God, and the expanse declares his handiwork. Isaiah exhorts us to lift up our eyes on high and see who created these stars. And in the pages of both the Old and New Testament, any light in the sky is considered to be a star, to include Saturn and what we now know today as planets. But in contemplating the cosmos, the Lord also exhorted Israel not to worship anything in the heavens. In Deuteronomy 4:19, God warns, quote, "And be careful not to raise your eyes to heaven and look at the sun, the moon, and the stars, all the heavenly lights, and allow yourself to be drawn away and worship them and serve them, things which the Lord your God has allotted to all the peoples under the whole heaven." End quote. God has allotted his heavens to all the peoples under the whole heaven for contemplating who he is and what he is like. The silent speech of the heavens themselves have indeed gone out throughout the whole world, declaring the glory of God. But we are not to worship the heavens or consult them regarding our future. Instead, the heavens should cultivate within us awe and worship of the Lord Jesus Christ, the one who fashioned them all by the breath of his mouth. The heavens were created through him and for him, including the wonders of Saturn and its rings. The heavens render us all without excuse, for God has shown them to us, and they reveal to us his invisible attributes. In that regard, contemplating the rings of Saturn, as we will be doing on the next two episodes of Good Heavens, can cultivate for us as Christians a deeper appreciation for who God is and what he has done for us in Christ. Saturn was one of the first celestial objects I had ever seen with a telescope, and I can tell you that there is nothing quite like seeing the little yellow ringed jewel in the eyepiece for the first time. That's Saturn! Wow, I'm actually looking at Saturn with my own two eyes. It's something I still say to myself every time I see it. So come and see and marvel the wonders of Saturn with Wayne and me today. Here on Part 1, we will dive into Saturn's mind-blowing geometric shape atop its North Pole and introduce you to some of the amazing discoveries uncovered by the Cassini probe, which dove between Saturn and its innermost ring in the fall of 2017. Good heavens, Wayne. It's another Good Heavens. And this time, we're talking about, I don't think we've ever done a topic on this. Maybe we have. You know better than I do. The planet Saturn. We're talking about Saturn today. Mostly, yeah. Mostly the rings, because there's
yes.
been some new stuff on the rings. But, you know, back in the day when Galileo was making his new telescopes, he made that drawing in his book that looked like Saturn had ears.
Yes.
And it wasn't until about 50 years later, Christian Huygens finally described, I think it was 1655, finally described what the rings are, what those ears turned out to be. And it's a beautiful system of rings made up of mostly icy rock and stuff. But you've been diving into the atmosphere and been swimming in and around the rings, Wayne. You've been doing some sciencing. You've scienced the rings, Wayne. So we're going to talk about Saturn, mostly its rings today.
It's appropriate that you mention Huygens and how little we knew about it then. We didn't know what it was.
He
just reported what he saw, right?
Yeah.
And then began to figure out some good things. Christian Huygens was a smart man.
Mm-hmm.
And today, what we're going to talk about is from the Cassini mission to Saturn. Cassini spacecraft took off from Earth in 1997, and mm-hmm. then the mission lasted until 2017.
Yeah.
And then it took years for scientists to sort out the data and images and figure this out. And it's amazing what they've been able to determine.
Yeah, and then it was in the fall of 2017. I remember this because they plunged Cassini into the atmosphere of Saturn, and it broke apart. But a lot of people associated in the past with Saturn. We have Galileo, we have Huygens, and then we have Cassini. Who is Cassini? Why did he get a space probe named after him? What was his contribution to Saturn science?
Yeah, he lived in the 1600s, and he's known for discovering some of the gaps in Saturn's rings, and he also discovered four of Saturn's moons.
Okay, so that's why you get a telescope or a satellite probe named after you. You discover things. Because up until Cassini's time, I mean, through Galileo and everybody, you didn't have a very big telescope that you could see the space between the rings. But now we know there are several gaps. It looks like a record, if you remember vinyl from the days of turntables.
Yes.
There are gaps in between the songs, right, on your vinyl, your old vinyls. And
And when you look at the pictures, it looks like a smooth white disc.
It does.
And you might see the gaps, but it's not a smooth white thing. It's many chunks of mostly water ice.
Right. Wayne, you grew up with Sesame Street, right?
A little, but I didn't watch it that much.
Okay, well, I did. I think Sesame Street, I watched maybe more than I should have, but I remember a sketch, and this has something to do with Saturn. There was those alien puppets that came down to that farmhouse, and they're in the outside in the window, and they come upon a telephone, and they don't know what the telephone is, and they consult their little alien guidebook.
Okay.
And they're like, chicken. And then do chicken sounds, and then they're like, nope, 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 nope. And then they go through a few things. And then the phone rings. The phone rings. And they freak out. And then it keeps ringing. And then they go, oh. And then they start imitating the rings. Like, ring. And it's really funny. And I thought about this. I don't know how it came to mind as I was preparing for this. But I think that's kind of how we are in relation to our exploration of the cosmos. You know, these aliens think this phone is a chicken. And I can't help but think of Galileo thinking that the planet, that Saturn had ears at one time, or the kind of explanations that we have had in the past for things that we have observed in the cosmos. We're like little kids exploring the universe. We really don't have any idea what we're looking at sometimes. Yes. But I think that gets, I'm not insulting astronomers or science. I just mean it in the sense of the kind of childlike wonder that you get when you study these things. And I think every astronomer or cosmologist who's involved in their field and loves what they do retains that childlike wonder about exploring the universe. And we get a lot of things wrong. You know, that's not a chicken.
Yes.
You know.
And I've often thought, think about the fact that God knows everything.
Hmm.
And he doesn't really have to discover things. He doesn't have to go find things out.
Right.
He just knows. Right. I think. But we kind of piece things together slowly.
Very slowly.
And we make mistakes, and we figure out things from our mistakes as well as other things we do, you know. And we get more and more facts, and we piece it together.
Yeah. Before we deep dive into your ring research, I did want to spellbind our audience. Maybe they know this, maybe they don't. That back in the early 80s, when Voyager 1 was flying through the planets, it did a little stop off at Saturn. And an astronomer by the name of David Godfrey, I believe, in the mid-80s, was taking the telemetry from Saturn piece by piece. And released in 1987 or 1988, a composite from all the telemetry from Voyager 1 of the North Pole of Saturn. Wayne, you know what's at the North Pole of Saturn?
It looks like a hexagon.
It is a hexagonal, almost a perfectly equilateral hexagonal hurricane. At the borders of this thing, which is, by the way, two Earths wide in terms of its diameter. The edges of the hexagon, the winds have been clocked at over 300 miles an hour. So, I mean, there's nothing like it in the solar system. There's nothing like it on Earth. And people are still trying to figure out why this thing has lasted as long as it has. Now,
yeah.
Physicists have created hexagonal shapes with their swirly machines and all the fun science that they do, certain liquids and certain speeds and a blender or whatever they do. But they've been able to recreate this to some degree. But recreating a hexagon in your swirly physics machine is a little less than trying to do this on the scale of two Earth sizes on the top of a planet. Now, there's no hexagon at the South Pole. So, you know, to me, the experiment in the lab that, oh, yeah, we recreated the hexagon. It's like, well, what does that say? That tacitly says that in order for you to make a hexagon in an atmosphere requires intelligence, right? Because you have all the lab tools, you have the experiment, you have the liquid, you're trying to bring facets together to create or to recreate what you're seeing in the universe. But David Godfrey's mosaic has it's been over 40 years now. It just continues to fascinate and astound people. So if you are listening to us now and you're on your computer, just pop on over and take a look at Saturn's hexagon. Pretty amazing. And it's also, as you know, Wayne, it's also the shape that bees prefer. When they make their honeycombs, they make perfect hexagons.
Yes, yes. You know?
So how fun that it is that you have hexagons in bees' honeycombs. And if you asked a bee, they would tell you why. They'd be like, well, it's the most efficient shape for our wax making because it takes about 8 ounces of honey for a bee to consume in order to produce an ounce of wax. So it's an efficient structure. It's a strong structure. It's a very practical structure. And it stores the maximum amount of honey. So the bees would have told you all this way before the Greeks or the Romans. They've been doing this for millennia. Gee, Wayne, where did they get that wisdom to make hexagons?
God designed it, I think.
I think so, yeah.
The bees do it by instinct.
The bees have been given an ancient wisdom. Hey, bees, I'm going to make you honey makers, and here's what you're going to do. And they follow the blueprint, and they've been doing the same thing for millennia. And I think also the hexagon on top of Saturn also reminds us of God's wisdom. Nobody expected to find a hexagonal hurricane on the top of Saturn in 1981.
Right. There's always a lot of surprises when we can discover things in more detail. And the hexagon, as I understand it, it's kind of a balance of forces between a lot of different spinning vortices.
Mm-hmm.
There's one big hurricane in the center of it.
Right.
And then there are lots of other smaller ones that are around the edges, on both inside and outside of it.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of delicate balance between all these different vortices that makes the shape.
Yep.
And it also changes color over the months. So
it does. It does.
There's a lot of things, Dan, about Saturn that you could delve into and spend a lot of time on. Recently I decided to delve into the rings more because there was a lot of new stuff that came out.
Yeah, yeah. So we've known about the rings since, over 400 years now, since Galileo first thought they were ears. But 400 years later, Wayne, they're still downloading and trying to figure out, not downloading, but they're still sifting through the downloaded data from Cassini and have come up with a remarkable conclusion. Some research is suggesting quite strongly, and this is not just creation science, but this is big NASA science, that the rings did not form with the planet.
Yes. It's been an ongoing debate for a long time, actually, that did the rings form about when Saturn formed? And, of course, most scientists believe that was about 4.5 billion years ago.
Same time as our Earth, roughly.
Yeah. Or did they form later? And there's been kind of two opinions on this among scientists. Well, the Cassini spacecraft did some really amazing things. It had some good instruments. So, for example, it was able to collect cosmic dust that falls on Saturn and Saturn's rings. It could figure out things like the velocity of the dust particles and about where they came from. It could figure out the composition of the cosmic dust particles. And they did studies of what happens to microscopic particles like that when they collide with the rings. What does that do to the rings? Mm. And so one little microscopic particle or something, maybe something as big as a sand grain, can collide with a piece of ice in the rings. And what does that do? Well, it creates ejecta. And then that ejecta creates more ejecta, and it sort of makes a chain reaction of particles that get scattered around, and this has a tendency to kind of slow down the ring particles, and all these little particles that are kicked up have a tendency to kind of drift into Saturn. So you have what's called ring rain, which is all these particles and other materials, even some gases, that fall onto Saturn's cloud tops from the rings. And they actually measured this phenomena. So, and at the end of the Cassini mission, this what they called the grand finale of the Cassini mission was it spent several orbits flying between Saturn's inner ring, the D ring, and the cloud tops of Saturn. So the spacecraft actually flew through the edges of the cloud tops of Saturn.
Hmm.
And wow. it collected material from this. So it's monitoring what's happening as it's doing this. It's collecting gases and particles and measuring what's going on there. It's amazing. Hmm. Wow. So this is amazing, very definitive experimental data on Saturn that the Cassini got, and it did it by doing the most dangerous thing you could do with a spacecraft. It's flying between the inner ring of Saturn and the cloud tops of Saturn.
Wow.
So it's amazing.
So, Wayne, let me ask you then. This research, I mean, all data has to be interpreted. But
yeah.
This seems to be, from what you're saying, conclusive enough for a lot of astronomers to step out and say, look, the way these rings are interacting, the dust, the ejecta, the ring rain, these couldn't have been around for 4.5 billion years. They would have all been gone by now, right?
Yes. Let me read a quote from two scientists that were summarizing their results. It says, from our own estimates of the mass inflow rates, now this is particles falling into Saturn's cloud tops from the rings, like I was talking about. From the mass inflow rates, we can calculate the remaining ring lifetime, taking the current ring mass to be 0.4 mimas masses, or 1.5 times 10 to the 19 kilograms. We find that the range of times for the remaining mass of the rings to fall into the planet is about 150 to 400 million years.
Wow.
So that would mean that Saturn's rings, if that range of numbers is right, Saturn's rings could not have formed when the planet formed, according to the scientific theories. It would have to have formed just a few hundred million years ago at the most.
Now, Wayne, I know that you'll get into this, but they're saying this was at one point a frozen moon that fell too close into the orbit of the planet and collided with Titan, or something like that?
That's kind of like some of their models. They've looked at different models or how this might have happened. So they're now forced to the conclusion, Dan, that they can no longer say the rings formed with the planet. They don't have that option anymore.
That's off the table.
It's because they believe they can't give up on the old age concept about the planet, right? Now, I question that too. But because they believe they have to say the planets are old, billions of years old, that means now they've concluded the rings are young compared to that. So they have to come up with new models now. They have to come up with new models to try and explain what would make these rings form long after the planet formed.
Well, you have an article, an older article that I read yesterday in preparation for our chit-chat about exoplanets. We've done a couple of episodes on exoplanets. I don't think we talked about this particular finding, but the Royal Society, I think you mentioned, had convened in 2010, and there was a group of astronomers that had presented a paper that looked at 6 of 27 exoplanets in a particular system. And I don't know if the 27, I don't remember if the study, they were all in one system or they were just a sampling. But they came up with 6 exoplanets that are like Jupiters, more or less. Mm-hmm. And they're all going in the, their orbits are in the opposite direction of the spin of their host star. And one of the lead astronomers says, we're just going to drop this bomb on you, that this really thrashes the protoplanetary disk assumption that we've long held about our own solar system. So before the advent of the Kepler Space Telescope Planet Hunter and the 5,000 or 6,000 exoplanets we now know, prior to just, you know, 15 years ago, we thought the protoplanetary disk model was it, a sun is accreting and spinning and all the excess detritus from the formation of the sun, all that stuff spinning in the direction of the sun's spin kind of comes together, and lo and behold, the magic collisions create planets. They're like, this is all being thrown to the wind in this particular system because these planets are orbiting opposite the direction of the spin. So there's a lot of exoplanet information that, added to this mystery of Saturn's rings, are starting to sound like our assumptions about planetary formation are becoming as difficult and knotty and problematic as star formation has been for astronomers for decades, right?
Oh yes, I think so. And that issue of the tilt of the planet orbits, of exoplanet orbits compared to the star, I've delved into that quite a bit too.
Right.
So because now that tilt for our system is like 7 degrees.
The sun, you mean the sun has a north and a south pole like the Earth does, and its axis is tilted at 7 degrees.
Yes.
So by the time you're out to, what is it, Neptune? That the angular degree, that there's a huge, like Neptune is way out of the angular disk of the sun's rotation.
Well, it's not that the angle changes. It's just that the distance becomes more as you get farther out.
Yeah.
But okay. Anyway, 7 degrees is not a big angle difference between the orbits of the planets and the tilt of our sun. And they don't consider it to be a big deal, although I don't think they really explained it. But in other systems like you're talking about, it's often maybe 50, 60 degrees or over 90 degrees. It's when that angle is more than 90 that you can say they are retrograde or they go opposite in direction.
In the opposite way, yeah. So Saturn's rings, what I hear you're saying, maybe, is that perhaps if you're looking at this from a perspective of a younger universe, a younger Earth, a younger solar system, that we might still be able to say that the planet and the rings formed at the same time, but that would make Saturn much younger, the planet, which they don't want to do. They don't want to concede that, well, maybe the planet is as young as the rings are, right?
Well, some scientists have been going in this direction, thinking this direction for years, but it's always been a debate and kind of an unresolved question. So I think that there, scientists are in planetary science are going to be forced to get used to the idea that Saturn's rings are younger than the planet. They don't have a choice. Now, if I were to look at this from a young age creation point of view, you know, from looking at things like the Bible teaches, it still kind of works for me to say that the rings could have been created when the planet was created, because God could do that. Because I'm not relying on just natural processes. I'm saying God could have supernaturally created.
You're not bound to the big material paradigm of ancientness, as many are. They just assume everything has to be old, and so they try to work from that perspective. Now, our critics would say, Wayne, that, well, you're just forcing a young Earth perspective on this whole mess, But really, all you're doing is saying, well, look, the science says these rings are young, but they don't want to concede that the planet is young, and so they have to come up with these really difficult scenarios in which the rings were created after the fact. But if you take a younger Earth universe perspective, that gives you the freedom to say they were created at the same time.
Yes, and so in a creation way of looking at this, it's the rings would not have disappeared in just a few thousand years. But if you try to say that the planet is billions of years old, the rings would disappear in long before that time. So that's why they now have to come up with new ideas to explain how the rings got there.
Gotcha, gotcha.
Now, well, let me add one thing, is that I've delved into a little bit of the science of how they get these estimates, okay? The number I quoted was from 150 to 400 million years. Uh-huh. And that lower number is kind of an interesting thing. And the scientists who gave that number, they first came up with the lower end number of 15 million years. And they made this statement in one of their papers that said, the lower bound estimate of 15 million years seems exceedingly short. And then they looked at some research of others, because others had estimated the time for these rings to fall into Saturn. And so because somebody else came up with an estimate of 100 million years, they changed their numbers. You know, when you do these kind of estimates, you have to make assumptions about certain parameters to put those parameters into your calculation. And the number you get in the end depends on the assumptions you make when you do the calculation. Yes. So there's more than one way these estimates could be done, and these are just estimates.
So you're saying, Wayne, that when we come to the question of the universe, in this case Saturn, that we have to begin with certain assumptions about what we're looking at in order to arrive at our hypothetical conclusions. And we're not saying there's anything wrong with making these assumptions, only right. to point out that in order to do research at all, you have to begin with certain assumptions that you finally really can't prove. And that seems to be what a lot of scientists are doing. They begin with and assume and don't even really question the assumptions with which they begin. So you have to be... I talked to Steve Meyer from the Discovery Institute a couple of years ago about his book, The God Hypothesis. And Steve was relating to me in his research how the mathematics of cosmology, the theories that try to get a universe without God, presuppose certain mathematical axioms in order to get a universe even to begin with. And Steve's saying, at the very heart of this is information. Where does this information even come from? How is it that we can use math to create a theoretical cosmos? And so what the cosmologists are doing are presupposing certain conditions that they themselves choose in order to get the outcomes that they're trying to get. And I think that's a lot of what we see with planetary science, that they're plugging numbers that assume a certain age and type about the universe.
Yes, and in this case, the number... There was a key number that had to do with what happens when particles hit the ring objects, and how much material is kicked up from that impact.
Yeah.
And then, so that's something that's we can't be very precise about. So what they ended up doing was using a range of numbers that they felt would be more accepted by other scientists.
Okay.
So I understand that what they did that, and they were honest about what they did, and I think that's good. But, you know, they're making estimates that depend on simulations and estimates, and they have to assume certain numbers to do it.
Yeah. Now, maybe I'm getting ahead of you here, but I thought it would be certainly fascinating to talk about briefly. I love... when I first found out about these things several years ago, the idea of, You know, there was a song by a singer in the 90s. Her name was Enya. And she had an album called Shepherd Moon.
Oh, yeah.
And that just kind of ruminated in my head. And I thought, well, where did that come from? Well, actually, it comes from Saturn. Because the rings have within them what they call shepherd moons. Now, these are like larger. They are moons. There's like a potato-shaped moon. And I just talked to Guillermo Gonzalez, you know. And he said the only other planet in our solar system where you could potentially get an eclipse would be from Saturn by its moon Prometheus. And Prometheus is a potato-shaped moon in the ring system. But it's flying so fast that an eclipse on Saturn, and the sun is much smaller from Saturn. So Prometheus, the potato-shaped moon, could actually block out the sun, Guillermo said, for about a second. But that's the only other place in the cosmos where you're going to get something like a full eclipse. But Prometheus is a shepherd moon, and I guess these things are within the ring system, and their momentum and their velocity is actually keeping all the little particles and dust kind of in an order, like a shepherd would keep his sheep, right?
Yeah, so let me describe the ring some more.
Yeah.
Because we're getting to that. So the rings were named with letters in the order of their discovery. And so you have from the outside big wide ones, it goes A, B, and C going inward. And then there's a D ring, which is a faint dust ring inside the C ring. So the A ring is the big wide one, and it's thicker than the others. Then you go in a little bit, and there's a gap, and there's the B ring, and there's another gap, then there's a C ring. Then there's the C ring kind of gradually changes in the D into the D ring.
Hmm.
Then there's E and F and G rings. Now the E, F, and G rings are outside of A, so those rings they had to jump to the outside, and so those rings are fainter. They're smaller, thinner. They're made up more of dust and different kinds of particles. But the F ring is like just a little bit outside the A ring. And the F ring has Prometheus and Pandora, I believe, is on either side of it. So they became known as the shepherd moons during the Voyager missions.
Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these stars, the one who leads forth their host by number. He calls them all by name. Because of the greatness of his might and the strength of his power, not one of them is missing. Good Heavens is a production of Watchman Fellowship Incorporated, Arlington, Texas. For more information on apologetics, cults, world religions, and our sister podcast, Apologetics Profile, visit watchman.org.